I'm Don Hodson, and this is an oral history interview for the Eastern Wyoming College Bicentennial Project. The date is August 19, 1975. I'm visiting with Frank Hughes, who lives on a farm between Yoder and Hawk Springs, Wyoming. His current address would be Yoder, Wyoming. Frank, would you mind giving me your name, please?
Full name is Francis Thomas Hughes.
And when were you born, Frank?
6th day of November, 1894.
Frank, would you mind telling me again where you were born?
I was born up here on the north side of Bear Mountain, close to Kessler's Gap, which is about 14 miles southwest of here, on the old Frank Yoder homestead. In a log house. Mother and Dad was living there at that time, in my birth. It was an awful election year, I remember that. They told me that.
Frank, how many were in your family?
There was 4 children, 3 boys and 1 girl. The girl was the youngest. And she was born at Wheatland, Wyoming, at our trading center at that time, trading spot.
What were your parents' names, Frank?
My dad's name was Isaac Newton Hughes, and my mother's name was Frances Sudana Nunn.
Frank, I wonder if very briefly, you might more or less just summarize your own life as an early young man out in this country. And
my first recollection of where I lived, of course, was up here just 2 miles south and half a mile west on the old R. Hughes, I. and Hughes homestead. It was contested. It had to contest it because it was taken by somebody previously. I don't know how far back, but he contested. There was nobody to appear. He piled on. And that's my first recollection. It's just a little horse creek flowed right through the. The homestead is 1 mile long and 1/4 wide, just 160 acres. And the creek flowed just through the half of it. That is the middle part of it, half on the north side, west side, and half on the east side. He proved up before John Hunton at Fort Laramie in about 1897 is when he filed or moved down there, and he must have filed in somewhere about 1902. You could file 3 in 3 years after your homestead, or you could let go 5. I don't recall when he did homestead or prove up on it.
Frank, you grew up in this country then, isn't that correct?
I was born and raised right here. I never got over 2.5 miles away from the original homestead.
Now, did you farm and ranch both, Frank?
We at home, you mean?
Yes.
It was a farm and ranch, yeah. Mostly hay. Dad didn't like to farm. He always said there's nothing in farming. Put in hay and raise cattle, horses, or livestock. We had both. He didn't like sheep. They were cattlemen at that time, didn't like sheep. Sheepmen. And we were the only ranch between Ike Gilder's, that's 6 miles south, and the river where Al Smith lived over there on that. They've torn the house down. Now it's a 2-story grout house on the river.
This is the North Platte?
North Platte River. You could travel there, just go right across, straight across, no trails, no roads, nothing. All you'd see would be wild game, besides horses and cattle, antelope, coyotes and jackrabbits, and prairie dogs, on a prairie dog town between. That all happened, or lasted a few years, of course, when Springer commenced to settle up in about 1906 or 7, right in there. And of course, they fenced the roads up. You had to commence to travel by section lines then, or maybe open gates to go through. They let you go through to get across the road. Horses, there was lots of horses. Henry Springer ran horses here in the early day in the holes here. Thousands of them seem to be like, wherever you see horses, you see Henry Springer's horses. He brandied a U on the left shoulder.
Well, Frank, you grew up then as kind of a ranching then.
I did.
And farming a little bit too?
Farming a little bit, just in order to get the sod broke up and put it in alfalfa as soon as you could. Of course, when you got started played out, then we put it back in the grain, but get it back in the hay as soon as possible.
Your wife is sitting beside you here, and when did you marry her?
June 15th, 1918.
And she was had come to this country, and I believe you had mentioned Mrs. Hughes in 1908, and your maiden name was
Smith.
Was Smith, right? Now, how many children have you had?
You better answer that.
We had three girls and a boy.
Then you've continued then in the 1930s and the 40s and up to the present time work this same area or piece of land.
Yeah, right here. I added a little to it, so build up so we could run about 70 cows, make a nice living that way. That's all I was interested in, was livestock and hay.
Mm-hmm. Frank, we talked a little bit earlier about your father who came out to this country. And I wonder if you might discuss a little bit about how he happened to come out here and what happened when he came and what he did.
Well, he knew a fellow back at Windsor where he was born that came out here to own Pumpkin Creek, who was a foreman of the Tussler, I believe they call it the Tussler Horse Outfit or Horse Company. He was a foreman. Dad knew him and he came out to Sydney on a train and rode across horseback to this Tussler ranch. Back in about, 1881, during just after a blizzard, the snow was all over, and he rode against the bright sun. He became snow blind. He said he never had anything hurt him so bad in life, just like needles in your eyes. He worked for them a while, and then he worked later for the Ogallala Cattle and Land Company down. They were headquartered down the rivers, I forgot. Then he worked for different outfits, run a wagon part of the time, a roundup wagon. And finally then he met my mother down Pumpkin Creek. They got married in 1890. They were born and married spring of 1894. And I was born that fall and up at Bear Mountain. He homed, and then Charlie, this fellow, Charlie Nelson, had this place picked out where Dad later homesteaded as a headquarters for a ranch, for starting a horse ranch. You had to have water, you had to have water first of all, and then you could graze out from that. But he finally gave that up and told Dad if he wanted to go ahead and contest and get it. And that's how he come to have that homestead across Horse Creek, south of here.
Now, how long then was that homestead in your family?
I hadn't thought about that. It must have been in the 40s sometime. Mother sold it then. So it was in their family something over 40 years.
You mentioned now your father came out in 1881, is that correct?
Punched cows until he was married in 1894. So he punched the cows 13 years before he settled down in America.
He would have been out here on the scene then during the period of really when these large ranches were in existence.
Yes, when they were being put together. Some of them, of course, were here before him even. Bear Creek was settled up before him, where the Kesslers and the Buns and the Muzzies and others up the creek there. It's an old settlement, Bear Creek, and Ronald LaGrange is old. Older than Torrington, really, I believe, at least. Of course, Torrington on the river, they found the water courses first, and this just happened to be down the creek. One place, only place he got on Horse Creek was at that time. All the rest of us taken up with the land. The Lincoln Land Townsite Company owned it. They were a subsidiary of the Burlington Railroad. They got it through, we think, fraud. They get a homestead, a cowboy's homestead, and then they took out a ditch and never had any water in it. But they'd have a jug pulled down behind the horse and have witnesses say they saw water running down the ditch. Or the other story about a boat. That's when they saw a boat floating down the ditch, the other side going down the ditch. There's different stories, of course, and we know it's true, only variation of the truth. On each side, they took it out and ditched on each side. On this side, there was two ditches taken out in places. You see them yet?
Well, did he ever talk much about those early cowboy days of his?
Not very much, because he was rather on the wild side. They were all wild. They liked to drink their liquor a little and shoot up the town.
Did he ever talk about some of the big ranchers or big ranches that he would have been acquainted with?
Yeah, he mentioned, I remember, Rangeford, he run horses up on the Chug Creek, I believe. And McElwalm's up Bear Creek, and Yoder, of course, Yoder and Marsha were here since I can remember them. They liquidated in my time. The Bay State, that's the place I was trying to think a while ago. Chris Streaks was forming the Bay State down in, on Pumpkin Creek, across on the other side of 66 up Raven Mountain. Not very much about the ranches, as I recall. I remember I was setting up one time late at night hearing another fellow who came there and stayed all night at our place talk about Tom Horn, and that kept me awake till midnight.
Do you recall the fellow's name?
Oh, yeah. Oh, this fellow's name was, I can't right now. He was a father-in-law of Eddie McCarty, I remember that much. Eddie McCarty was the one that he ran a rodeo string later, furnished a rodeo string for these fairs, like this George Bootman does now. He'll have his outfit, I guess, at the Torrington Fair this fall, just tomorrow, next day, George Bootman, and also Ray Blunt from Guernsey. Cy Doty was one of the few who survived that awful winter of 86 and 87. It just mowed so many of the cattlemen down to nothing. They just took everything they had. He survived it. He had at one time 50,000 head of cattle. And whether they're all in the holes or not, I don't suppose they were, but he lived on what's called the Doty Ranch, west of Torrington, just about due west of Torrington, south of Fort Laramie there. And that's how Dad got started in the cattle business. He was Dad's banker, as well as my uncle, who came out here later. He loaned him money to get started in the cattle business. Cy Doty, he was one of the big ones. I'd forgotten about that.
You mentioned Tom Horn, this fellow coming in and talking about Tom Horn, and I suppose you were a young
just about
boy at that
8 or 10 years old, and I just
turned
to him. Tom was quite a killer.
He was, of course, on everyone's thoughts for a while, wasn't he, Tom Horn?
He was, of course, hired by the cattleman who wanted to get rid. If they wanted to get rid of somebody, he was a paid killer, and he killed her. How come him to get caught? He killed the wrong person, and Joe DeForest got him pretty well drunk and got his confession, and it was recorded as he was against him in the trial. He was convicted and hung.
Do you recall what this fellow was had to say about Tom Horn that night?
Yeah, what impressed me, he said he could tell when Tom Horn was going to have a killing because he was real nervous. He'd get nervous and fidgety. He could always tell when he's hired to do a killing. And that's about all I recall about that. And I'm sorry I can't even tell that man's name.
Were there a lot of people in the area that were scared of Tom Horn? Did he have a reputation such that people were afraid of him?
No, he had friends. He had friends. Because he was estranged and they didn't catch him right away. He had friends to cover up for him. And he'd come in and felt well. Of course, he felt sure. The cattlemen, he still knew the cattlemen, of course, and they had tremendous influence in this state. The Wyoming Stock Growers Association was a power in the state, always have been, and still are. And so he felt pretty secure. He said he'd never hang. He felt sure he wouldn't hang till right at the last. But in connection with his hanging, I remember the date. Very definite. I could just read headlines. November 20th, 1903, Tom Horn will hung. I remember that headline. And Charlie and Frank Irwin sang at his funeral. They sang the Life is like a railroad. They sang that. And they came to our house one day, still all night, and they sang that at our request. We had an organ. And Frank would play the piano, and Charlie Irwin could sing. And he was a monster fellow, great big 350, 60 pound deep voice. And that's quite entertaining.
Those early years when you were growing up then, what do you recall about some of those early times, Frank, as a young boy out
one thing I recall in particular, a fellow named Roy Phillips rode up here from Reddington in one day, 60 miles on one horse, of course, on horse. And that was quite a ride at that time. I know that impressed me, of course. There were a lot of good horses. There was horses that would do that all right, but it took a good horse to ride 60 miles. He was a big fella too. All one day.
Where was Reddington, Frank?
Reddington's a little inland town, about 10 miles up from jail, from the road going out to the Greenwood Ranch. I speak about the Tussler, originally the Tussler Ranch where Dad came and worked under Charlie Nelson, about 10 miles up on 88. And that'd be 60 miles on the way to the ranch. The ranch, you see, was a kind of a stopping place. It was crossroads. The old ranch of Dad's up there. And there's a lot of people came in there and stopped, stayed all night. Of course, you had to. You a long ways to the next place, you know, to stay. And your last string was out to anybody that come along, still alive, but you never turned anybody down. That was one of the things I remember. And Ray, fellow named Ray Tarble, I'll call it Tarble. I used to think it's Tarble, but it's Ray Tarble. I remember he stopped in there one night, and he had the reputation of having killed a person. Of course, that was exciting to us, you know, Ray Tarble. Another fellow I might mention. There's a cattle buyer, name of John Kelly. By the way, he's Ellis Kelly's uncle. I've talked to Ellis about this. We've had conversations about old John Kelly. He'd come through and stay all night, buy cattle. And I remember he had a deformed finger. And somebody told me from the grapevine, said a bullet went through that finger. So one time he's down there and I asked him, I want to find out for sure. And I says, Mr. Kelly, what made that finger? He said, deformed. A bullet went through there. I said, I look at that finger, you know, that's by. So he was kind of a quick talker. I told this to John. I said, John is Brian? No, he couldn't remember. I says, I heard a fellow ask him what his name was, or his brand was, and he said, Tubell. I couldn't understand. He finally found out it's Tub L. And he said, Tubell. Fast talking sort of fellow. That tickled Ellis. I told him that. Then another time, there was a Negro, the first Negro I ever saw, he came through buying cattle. And since my folks were raised in the South, he didn't sit at the table where we ate. But right here, cornered, we set a little table at the corner of the table. He sat there, and we just passed the food from our table to him. He'd take it and hand it back. And I and my junior kid way, I couldn't understand why that'd be any different. Right there, why couldn't he sit around the table? But it was, just so he didn't. That's his table, and that's our table. And he, mother said, now we were the South. She explained to him before he sat down there. We were the South, and he, of course, he understood that. Great big Negro, first black man I ever saw.
Frank, were there any really Negro cowboys on the scene when you were
there
a young boy?
But I never saw them. They were good, and they were good. I heard that they were good. There's a story in that book, Banditti of the Plains, mm-hmm. about a Negro coon. He was drunk and rode a steer out in through a Western clothes establishment. The steer had clothes on. Went on through and down the street. There's quite a story in that Banditti of the Plains. But I've heard they did. You see, after the war, there was just nothing to do out there. And of course, some of these, I suppose, were run away from, were free if they got out here. They wouldn't send them back. They were good cowpunchers. I've heard them talking about them, but I never knew them personally.
Now, this was this area that you were in, of course, was considered to be Goshen Hole, wasn't it?
Right.
What really is the area of Goshen Hole? Where does it
start? In 66, goes right around here and comes at, and I would assume it'd come this side of Cold Spring Hill and goes to the state line. Because 66 over here is just, well, it's right, part of it's right on the state line. It's just this rim. The rim.
In other words, it's the whole area then, the entire area below the rim.
Right. It probably would be roughly 20 miles, 25 miles across, and then some up in the notch. You go up the notch, that's way back there. You'd probably be 40, 50 miles from the state line up there, 40 miles, I suppose, to the head. Of course, then it drops back around these, and they're about 12, 15 miles out west here. I might tell you about this, the first post office we had. I used to ride across there 12 miles to get it when I was a kid, just once every 2 weeks because it's so far. Take a horseback. And it was at the mouth of Lone Tree Canyon called Sri Lona. And just back of Lone Tree, it came from a lone tree that's way down this side, set out there all of itself. And that's where it got its name when they turned around called Tree Lone.
When did they? I don't want to interrupt. When did they start using the term Lone Tree?
I couldn't, as far back as I can remember, Lone Tree. That's the Lone Tree Canyon that goes up. It's one of the longest. It's the longest canyon in this whole. Sweep of hills around. It's practically 3 to 4 miles long. And the tree lone was right at the mouth of it. little stream comes out of there. Charlie Weatherwax lived there and kept the stores, kept the post office when we got our mail there. He'd come across from Meriden, come out from Cheyenne, and then they'd call and haul it across from Meriden post office. Then later we had Hagee, of course, that's way later, about 1945. Hagee was established, that was just 4 miles south of the ranch up here. Al Hagee took the homestead and petitioned the government and got a home, got the post office out there. And this closer to 4 miles compared to 12.
What about your early schooling, Frank?
That's part of this house where I first went to school. Well, not where I first went to school. We used our house and now Uncle Tom's. We live just half a mile up west of us, alternate between school season, we'd have it in our place and then up to his bunkhouse up there. Until we moved this schoolhouse down from the Ori Sebring Canyon, way up there. Phone name of, can't think of his name right now, but Weatherwax then moved over close to that place. It's the Sebring Canyon, anyway, still known as the Sebring Canyon. We took it all apart, moved it down here, and set it up just halfway between Wilfrid lives and Wilson. And that was about 1904. Florence Sandercock from Fort Laramie, the Sandercocks up there, were their first teacher. 1904 and 5. We had full 7 or 8 months at that time. First years would just be 3 or 4 months, depending on how much money was in the treasury. And that's where I graduated, and that's how it is. The kitchen there is the most part of it. It comes this side of the station dog. Moved down here, and this house just growed, as Topsy did. Just put together 4 or 5 different buildings, and then built on to it. Graduated in 1911.
Now, was that graduated from what?
Eighth grade.
From eighth grade. There was no high school probably in the whole country, was there?
No, well, let's see. Blanche graduated from Torrington. She was one of the first. You tell about that.
I know Picard well.
You do too.
Well, I was wondering, you went to high school in Torrington, Mrs. Hughes? And you were one of the first graduates from the high school there?
One of the early ones.
She was one of two. She was a girl named Ella Spencer, and she was the only two graduates.
Hazel.
Hazel Spencer in 1916, same year as I graduated in Scotts Bluff.
So you could then go to the nearest high school then would have been Torrington.
It was the nearest one, yes. I doubt it. Well, the Lingle had it. Scotts Bluff, of course, had it, but that's quite a way down.
Frank, you were growing up in a period of time in which, really, I suppose, the large ranches had more or less given away or been broken up into the smaller.
The real large ranches, yes, had.
What were some of the ranches that you recall as a young boy that more or less were more prominent or?
The White Cross Ranch is the nearest ranch is in my mind. It was jointly owned by Jeff Schroeder and Franz Marsh, who had a ranch way up Bear Creek, way up there, about the head, the last one on the river or creek. I can't recall any big ranch except the Yoder. Most of the people had this is all free range, and they didn't need big ranches. You see, they just turned their stock out. We put up a little hay for them in the wintertime and turn them out free range here up till about 19. When the prince was settled up in 10, 11, 12 in there. They fenced this government land up till 1906. Teddy Roosevelt was president. He said the fences must come down. Some of the old ranches they weren't going to, but they did. he was crawling up now. He ordered them down, they came down. You probably remember Teddy Roosevelt. Fences must, that's another headline that I can remember. The fences must come down. They came down in 1906.
What about, were there any, what you recall, some rather interesting characters on the scene as far as early ranchers?
Oh, yes. Military Jack up here was one of the ones I, as a kid, remember about. L.L. Fulton was his name. He was up now on the place where the Werners, old Bill Werner, got the place later. And the boys, Bill's dead, and his boys, Art and Earl. Earl. Live up there, two brothers. And he was a fella who they called Miller, his name, nickname was Military Jack. He was from the Army, no doubt, because he wore military clothes oftentimes. And he's always thinking people are stealing his horses, which no doubt he did lose a few. But if he'd see you coming, the story is he'd go back up the canyon and peek around and see who it was before he'd come down and recognize him. Dad was up there one time, and he didn't see anybody, and knocked around there, nobody there, and finally saw Millie. Dad called him Millie. Sneaking down, looking, Dad's here, Millie. Always had his rifle. Dad's here, Millie, I'm Mark Hughes, you know me, don't you need be shooting or pointing your gun this way. So he came on down. I can remember only seeing him once. He came down, stayed all night at our place. And he was telling the story about his sleeping out one time, and he felt something brush across his face. And
just mentioned about your acquaintance with John Hunton, an early day a pioneer. I wonder if you would talk about him a little bit, Frank.
Are we on now?
Yes.
John Hunton was a United States land commissioner, located at Fort Laramie, and he was a Southerner. He came from Virginia, and when you come in there, that was the United States office, and you took off your hat, and you paid respect to that office, and Dad proved up under him. He was quite an imposing looking man. He was large man, tall man, but he had, his eyes were fading when I saw him, and he wore real dark glasses, and of course that, you couldn't see his expression. I never saw him once or twice. I remember his wife, Blanche, is with him. He got this woman from, well, his old sweetheart, I guess, and he come out here, though, and he married, of course, an Indian girl, Lolly, first, and she, though, didn't like the American ways, so she went back to her tribe, and then later then he built this house up the LD, great big tall house, 12-foot ceilings, especially for Blanche. That's after he moved from, I don't know what the, how the way it's done, but he lived in Fort Laramie. He was a settler at Fort Laramie, and then, of course, he built this house later where Blanche lived on the LD. That's south and west of Laramie. Of course, his memoirs, we've read them. You probably have.
You met him, didn't you, personally, Frank?
I was a young fella. I just knew who he was, put it that way. Maybe I didn't. I just don't remember. I never talked with him. Dad knew him. He talked with him. But he was quite a fella, I guess you could tell that.
What did your dad think of him, Frank?
Oh, he honored him, fella. He was well respected. John Hunton was a man, a big man in the country here. Honest, hard working, blacksmith. He repaired, worked out there in the shop in the cold.
What about it? Were there any other, you mentioned Military Jack, we talked about John Hunton a little bit. Were there any other characters or colorful persons out here in those early years?
I remember talking about, they talked about these foremen, the two bars. See, they were, the headquarters was Swan Land Cattle Company, it was at Chugwater. They'd come down here, round up in the summertime, had two roundups. They'd run that round up in the summertime and brand the calves. Then later they'd gather the beef in the fall, gather the beef to sell. And these, they didn't sell calves like we usually do now. But the ones who run the old Morris, Dave Morris, he was a Westerner, kind of a drinker, wild fellow, but he pushed his cowboys. He talked about how he'd get them up early in the morning. You get up early, you worked all day, and he'd drive those boys from one brand to the other. I remember seeing him. He had a spot between times of serving as a foreman, several years, and I'd hear him talk about his earlier days, and then I looked forward to seeing him later, which I did. He was later employed as a foreman. He was quite a character. I don't know any more about him, but he'd push his men hard. Then another roundup foreman was Frank Roach. He was a nicer fellow. Frank Carter was another fellow. He was just a cowboy, though. Colorful, because he was a good buster, bronco buster. He took the prize over here at Torrington when he was called the Goshen County Fair Festival, which that picture you see represents.
These early ranch foremen or managers must have been pretty well thought of and pretty well known around the area.
They were upstanding men. They had to be, to stay here, they had to be rough and tough and honest. Put it that way.
What about some of those early day cowboys that you can recall?
Jim Mallory was one, Dempsey Thomas, Bob Brazil, Ed Ferguson. I remember Bill Warner. He was the old bar O, came down here as a rep with the two bar. They had representatives. They'd go around and gather the cattle of the company they represented, watch out for their interests, and they'd travel with the Swan Land, or the two bar, we call them. That's, you got the name of it, there's a brand, two bars on the left hip. And then they had a year brand on the side. If it was 1906, they'd put a six on the left rib, seven, so on up to zero. Mike Griffin was one. He later was old Kurt Griffin run the shotgun, what to call a shotgun. That is a roundup of the ranchers up Bear Creek. They'd come down and gather their cattle, because they threw their cattle in on the Ocean Hole here, along with the two bar and others, whoever lives here, turn out on the range in the summertime. And Kurt Griffin was their ramrod. There's their foreman. Elizabeth Davis is his granddaughter. That's Jim Davis' wife.
Go ahead.
One incident I can recall is my uncle. He had an outlaw mare that he loaned to a fella. And he put his saddle on him, and this mare got away and left him afoot. You couldn't catch her. She's an outlaw. She ride good, but then when she got away, you couldn't catch her. You couldn't run her down. So the thing to do is just go shoot her. So that's what he did to get his cattle. He went and killed his good mare. But that's the way he gets his saddle. That always impressed me, shooting a mare to get a saddle.
Now, you mentioned a lot of those early cowboys were pretty tough characters.
Mm-hmm.
Was this pretty much the typical of the early cowboys, that they were rather rough?
They were rough. They had a reputation to uphold from the former generations, of course. Yes, I better not get too personal. Some of these people are living here yet. I can tell some stories I've heard.
Tell the story, maybe forget the name if you want, but I'd like to hear the story.
Well, LaGrange had the reputation of being pretty wild, and a couple of local boys there shot out the lights in the or they're having a dance in the dance hall up there, and they cleaned out. They were afraid then that after they'd done it, they knew the law might get after them, so they cleaned out and laid low for quite a while before they came back. And they're still living. One of them is still living. The other, they're awful close. Their kids are still living. The boys are still living. I guess they're dead. So.
Was there much gunplay, so to speak?
Oh, no, I never... That was before my time. There was gunplay, all right, but more for excitement, you know. They'd shoot as they had their guns. Of course, my dad always carried a 45, pearl handle 45 Colt. I can tell a story, but my mother, he was showing off before my mother one time on a bucking horse. He made him horse buck. And I guess he didn't get bucked off, but his six shooter and plug of tobacco went tumble over and over. They'd buy this plug tobacco a pound at a time, pound long. It only cost 50 cents a pound. Big, long slab of flat, called flat tobacco. That's what they know in the East. You had those twists in the East or the South, the twist, and then when they got to manufacture, they called it the flat. Put a lot of stuff with it, licorice and one thing, that'll make it a little milder and a little more tasty. That's one incident I remember. Mother tell that on Dad before they married. They both went out of his pockets tumbling in the dirt.
Well, did those early cowboys still wear a gun?
Oh, yeah. That his dad did, I suppose, as a thing to do. They'd wear, carry a gun, of course. They claim they'd shoot the rattlesnakes with them. They would, they'd shoot. And mostly, Dad came in, you see, after the... Well, you see, it was a pretty tough time. This just Johnson County Cattle War was in 1892 in the spring. And Dad and my uncle didn't want to have anything to do with that. They had friends on both sides, and so they went back to Missouri until that blew over. And they didn't want any part of it. But Tom Lacey... He used to live a mile across here. He was up there at the time that they came and got these regulators that they got held hole up there in the jail for protection. The United States Army protected these regulators, or the invaders they were called. And he was there when they came and got them. But Dad didn't want it, because they were from Texas. The Laces from Texas came up on the trail. Dad didn't.
What about rustling, Frank? Was there much rustling going on?
There was rustling, sure. There was some rustling. Blotching brands. I never saw anything of that. You'd get you're entitled to, like, that longest rope. He was a slick. You first one caught him was yours, if you had cattle. But of course, that's where these got in bad with the rustlers. They, with the cattlemen, they brand these slicks when they didn't have any cattle. So naturally, they didn't belong to them. If you had cattle, whose was it? It's free, you see. If you owned cattle. Once in a while, we'd get a slick. We'd get one. We'd butcher it, usually, if we'd get a slick. Might be ours, might not. Probably wasn't.
You don't recall anyone ever being hung, though, for cattle stealing
as no, a young man? No, not my time. There's hanging horse thieves before my time. Frank, in what ways would you say that the country has really changed since those early days? You've probably seen a lot of changes. Of course, the biggest change, I think, is this when they learned how to raise wheat here. The country changed by summer fowling, with 2 years, 2 years moisture, save up 2 years moisture, and then they raise pretty good wheat crop. And then, of course, another big change is putting this land back, crested wheat and tame grasses. They plowed a lot of this up, shouldn't have been plowed up, you see, and they've got it back. Then in grass was crested wheat and other grasses. That's been a big change. Stopped this blowing in the 30s. This country just about blew away, especially the lighter ground. Oh, of course, the automobile is really what changed the picture. We got highways in, get closer to, save a lot of time going to town when you had team and wagon stay overnight. That's about my most impressive time, the first car we had. And of course, we owned a car. That was a big event. And a couple of electric lights coming in, that's recent, 39, when we first got the electric lights. That made a lot of difference. Helped living.
Well, Frank, you saw this country before. I suppose there were very little of it broken out when you were
young. None of it broken out except for along where they could get water on. There's no dry land farming at all. You had to have water. If you didn't have water, you didn't break it up.
Was it a pretty dry, barren land,
it very dry? It's listed as semi-arid, and some people think it's really near arid, but it's semi-arid.
What about as you look down on the Platte? Was it wooded as heavily then in the early 1900s?
No, it wasn't. Today? I know there's some trees, but I think it's more. See, the cattle would eat these up. There wasn't any wood along the Platte till you got up probably up in the hills. Fort Laramie probably picked up up there. I know the wood is awful scarce along the Platte, I've read that anyway, these prairie schooners come across, wood is very scarce. They use buffalo chips, they call it. Buffalo would eat, first the buffalo ate them up on the creek, and then the buffalo was killed off. The cattle kept the trees down until they were fenced. I can't recall very little trees till later years.
They mentioned as you would ride across this country, you would see a lot of horses.
Very many horses and cattle. And a lot of antelope.
I was wondering about the cattle now. Was it quite filled even then in the early 1900s with cattle?
Yes, it was too many cattle really for the grass at that time. It kept getting a little worse. Worse, especially the Two-Bar brought in sheep then along the 19, 10, 11, 12. They had sheep in here, and they're hard on. Cattle just don't follow sheep because the sheep eats us so close. Wolves, there's wolves in the area at that time. I've seen gray wolves out here. Not many, but you'd see them. They're so much bigger than coyotes, you could tell them on the way off.
What about ranches? Were there quite a number of ranches so that it wasn't really too far before you'd ride into a ranch house at that time?
Well, when I first can remember, I call that. There was a ranch at Greasewood. That's right west of Yoder, a mile or two there, where Clyde Yike lives right close to it now. There was a Ike Yoder ranch 6 miles south. There's a Crockett ranch 6 miles east. And then this Lone Tree ranch. That was just about it. It's our closest ranches. They were none of them closer than 6 miles. And not a fence between till you got that ranch and you opened the gate and went in his place.
Now, when the homesteaders started coming in, I suppose there was a fair amount of friction between those early ranchers.
Oh, yes.
And the homesteaders.
We called them wrinkle bellies. Yeah. That's what they starved out about. They had wrinkles in their belly because they didn't have enough to eat. They lived on jackrabbits. I've heard them talk about living on jackrabbits if they run out of food. They took all the land up. Beginning about 1908, and it all just went pretty fast. See, mine is 15, and it was just, it's all gone in 1915. This area here was segregated pending the decision when this government ditch would come through. They had a survey that went south of here. It crossed the creek a mile south of where Dad homesteaded there. And of course, that put all this under. They decided not, that's too expensive, and for the anyway, they changed and settled on this and this present one, which is across the creek about 2 miles north of here at the siphon. And then they throw this land segregated, they throw it open for homestead, and that's how I came to get the homestead here that joins the corners my dad's place. Well, it laps down a quarter of a mile on it, my original homestead on the school section. So it all was taken up then.
Well, what about, did any of the ranchers try to run off these homesteaders?
No. No, they didn't.
They didn't,
civilize.
They didn't get into any cases of taking the law in their own hands?
No, not here, no.
What was it, mostly just words exchanged or looks?
That's it, yeah. They might threaten their bulldozers, scare them off, threaten them or something, but nothing violent at all. Just.
Did they cut any fences?
I don't recall a fence cut at all, no.
They didn't, did they kill any stock of any farmers?
I expect they did. I don't know of any. There was some robbing just recently. Of course, that's been done all the time. Taking Oral Vance up here lost. He knows that they come in there and butchered a beef and got away with it. No one ever found out who it was. But just isolated cases.
Frank, we talked about some of the early communities, and you mentioned Springer was one. How far does Springer go back into existence?
It's about 7 or 8. They were here before they came. They came in 8, Smiths. They were here before that. It could have been in 6.
Now, where was this located, Springer?
Springer was located in 3 miles down, 3 miles north of here and a mile west, just right north of the Springer Dam. That's just a quarter of a mile north of Springer Dam, or the outlet where they let the water out for irrigation.
Now, was it this town was named, or this, what, was there a post office, I suppose,
there? Post office there, called Springer. They brought the mail out from Torrington. They let a contract, you bid on it. Some name of Hewitt had it one time, and whether he was the first one to carry it, do you remember?
First one I can remember.
Well, it was named after a fellow by the name of Springer, wasn't it?
Yes, Henry Springer is the one that took out the project. This the they call it the Goshen whole reservoir, I believe, to top this ditch a mile south and fill the reservoirs. Again, the reservoir is only a mile north of here. So it's only a 2 mile ditch by section line. Of course, it hooked around probably measured close to 3 miles, and that was a Springer project. And the school section was under that, and the section west of the Silver Tip corner there, that's the southeast corner of that section, and that was all under the Springer project, plus the section just east of there. Warple lives on part of that. Well, he'd live on, he'd be under, not on that section, the section's right south. The Prentices, where Swank lives now and runs the elevator in Yoder, he lives on one of the original places under the project. It's Prentices. They came out here about the time you did, I think, about 1908.
What was a Springer project? Now, this was an irrigation project.
Irrigation project. He took out, I can't tell you the details of the law, but you could get, the idea was our Wyoming laws are based on the beneficial use of water. And of course, he saw this water going down the, he run the horses all over Goshen Hole, and he saw this water going down Horse Creek. And he said, and spotted this place where he could take out a short ditch and get a lot of land under it, get his two sons-in-law and his brother and others interested. And I don't know whether he'd sell it to them. I don't know what the details, but it was all under the Springer project, and of course still is. I don't know how many acres. He puts in his 3,000 acre feet of water in that reservoir.
This was started by what was his name?
Henry Springer.
And did you know him, Frank?
Oh yes, I used to help him round up his horses. In fact, I got that down in about 1904 or 1905. I was about 10 years old. He hired me to go out with him and round up these horses. And there's crells, different crells around. It's the 2-bar you use. Well, we'd use them to round up these horses. And he'd cut out what he wanted and leave in the crell there, and later pick them up. That's the first money I ever made, was working for Henry Springer, riding after these horses.
What kind of a fellow was Henry Springer?
He was a great, big, very imposing-looking fellow. In fact, I believe he was elected to the, maybe just the county commissioner. Prominent man in Mitchell Bottom. He lived down just in Mitchell Bottom. That'd be about 3 or 4 miles south of Mitchell, southwest of Mitchell. He never lived up here, but his son and his two daughters, or their husbands, lived up here under that project. They did all right. Ed Deering, he was one of the starters of the Citizen National Bank and Trust Company in Torring. Ed Deering, Royce Tibbetts, and W.O. Eaton. Their names on the corner there, if you notice. Ed Deering was a son-in-law. And then the other son-in-law's name was Lon Merchant. And Dorothy Warple is his daughter.
Did this project then attract quite a few people into the area?
Well, that would help, of course, but there was only about a limited number in the ditch, 8 or 10. I suppose about 10 would cover that. No, what attracted them was just land hungry. That's been the history of Eastern people coming out. They wanted a place of their own. If they found a free land, all it took was your filing fee and 6 months you established residence, and you stayed on that for 3 years, made your home 3 years, you prove up, and go to paying taxes, of course, which I did just as fast as I could. I proved up in 3 years so I could be a tax-paying citizen. I thought that's quite an honor to pay taxes.
Frank, were there any other irrigation projects or in the area before the Springer project that you recall?
That's the first project that I recall. The next project would be the Hawk Springs and then the Bump Sullivan. Bump Sullivan might have been Bump Sullivan first, I guess, and then the Hawk Springs. Hawk Springs is larger, of course. It's 16,000 acre feet in that.
These all occurred before the building of the large ditch out of Whelan Dam?
The Springer did. The Whelan Dam came down through by, or the ditch 1912. About, yeah, it might have been spring of the Selby Cut. I'm trying to think when that was. Around 12 through here. It started before that. Probably started about 10.
The north side ditch.
North side was earlier. On the other side, this was 1905 or 6. It came out up to on the north side. The railroad came up on that side.
What about Springer? How long did it exist till about when then?
The Springer Post Office. Mm-hmm. Later there was Stewart. It went on out to Stewart. That's the Platt neighborhood. Platt located all those people. A fellow named William Platt located most of those people all out in the area. South and west of Yoder, it goes way over Smith's, and south of the range line is 3 miles south of here. I would say 4 or 5 years,
yeah.
Something like that. And then Torrington, then you see, this is. Well, they had a route then out of, how long, I was wondering about Yoder. Yoder, you see, came in 21, and that would have voided if nothing else did, but it didn't last that long. You didn't have it in 18, no.
Or 16.
From 8 till probably 8 years, would you say? 8 to 8.
No longer than that.
No longer 16.
Were there any other small communities around that we no longer hear about today?
Lakeview, way up west, that's the Clark. Did they mention Clark? Did Clark mention Lakeview?
Stewart
was an inland post office. Hagee was. Take quite a while. It was moved over. McMillan's east of there about 4 miles, and they kept that over there until the railroad came in.
Where was Hagee now?
Hagee was originally 4 miles south of the old ranch. That'd be just east of Hawk Springs, mile south of Hawk Springs, a mile east as original. Then it's moved down 2 miles north of there. It was there several years. Then it's moved over east, probably 3 or 4 miles over east at McMillan's. Bob McMillan lives there now.
So there's Springer, Hagee, Stewart, Lakeview.
I wouldn't say Lakeview is a post office. It's a community.
Well, Frank, in the years then that you've lived out here, I imagine you've seen quite a few changes in the ranching practices from those early.